This is a Rain rerun, part two of a program looking at coax, originally aired March of 2003.
I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ, with the Rain Report. This week we bring you the conclusion of our look at amateur radio's lifeline, coax. Here's Hap Holly, KC9RP, with the conclusion of his interview with Ron Steer, W9ICZ, former 37-year employee with Belden Wire and Cable.
You know, when you talk about these multi-layers within the jacket of the coaxial cable, that must be a manufacturing nightmare.
First of all, the first challenge is maintaining the concentricity. In other words, the placement of that center conductor in the dead center of the insulation.
How do you do that?
With tensioning devices and your control of your speed, the control of the output of the melted polyethylene as it's coming out of the die. I mean, there are a lot of different combinations to control it. That's the first stage, really, in terms of the real control. One of the other things that a lot of people don't recognize in coaxial cable, if you're familiar with high voltage principles, let's say you're blasting a piece of glass with extremely high voltage, it will not penetrate that glass, but you will get a place in the glass where there is just a slight air bubble or something of that nature, and there you will develop what you call a stress point from the high voltage. And it's just like taking a pencil and sharpening it down, if you will, and if you can imagine the point into the glass, that's exactly what happens to the high voltage. It just goes right down a conical point. When you get that, it starts eroding, and eventually it will penetrate the glass. So with coaxial cable, if you have small air gaps between the conductor and the insulation, typically in RF situations, that will not be a problem, but if you are applying high voltage to it, you can have a blowout at those points where the insulation is just a very, very minute gap, less than 100 thousandths of an inch. It's enough to take and start to cause the stress point for the high voltage to arc through and blow through the polyethylene.
Is that really going to happen with the power levels that we have in amateur radio?
Not in amateur radio, no. At least I'm not aware of it. That's not to say that somebody hasn't done it. That's one thing I found in amateur radio. If there's a way not to do something, they'll find a way to do it.
Ron, back in the 70s, along with RG8X, a cable called 9913, often referred to in those days as flexible hardline, became popular. How does that differ from your run-of-the-mill RG8 type coax?
The difference there primarily is the fact that they were able to take and make a significant increase in the size of the center conductor by using polyethylene threads as spacers so that you were able to introduce far more air into the line, making the velocity of propagation upwards of 85-87%. By getting that much air into the line, you were able to retain the overall OD for the standard PL-259s. Even so, they still had to take and shave the center conductor to make it work for the PL-259. I think most of the guys started moving towards the N-type connectors, which again were more readily adaptable to that size of center conductor, and then they had an adapter go from the N connector to the PL-259 or change their receiving port on it to be able to connect directly with it.
Now, the PL-259 is your run-of-the-mill coax connector that you screw onto most any SO-239 threaded chassis mount connector.
Right.
N connectors are used more commercially than anything else. Why is that?
They have a more consistent characteristic impedance from unit to unit. They're more precision. PL-259, it's probably plus or minus 5 ohms as a characteristic impedance, where your ends are plus or minus 1 or 2 ohms. When you're getting up into the VHF, especially the UHF, but VHF is still key in this issue, if you look at your attenuation curves, you start moving up to 50 megahertz, attenuation really starts to take an elbow up on your graphs. So that was one of the design considerations behind the 9913, to give much lower loss up in those higher frequencies while maintaining a rigid characteristic impedance. But when you get up into those frequencies, your mismatch of your characteristic impedance really jeopardizes the amount of signal that you're going to be able to squirt out of that antenna. You'll get major reflections and feedback, and it's pretty hard for most any tuner to really make the perfect match on it. And again, they try to stay away from tuners wherever possible at those ultra-high frequencies and VHF frequencies, because within the tuners themselves, you have some significant power loss. So the combination of having impedance mismatch at your connections and then the tuner loss, you might start out with 25 watts, and by the time it's getting out of the antenna, you might be down to 2, 5, or 6 watts or something like that, depending upon the severity of the mismatch and the length of your run. We drop back to your question before, and I think this is very appropriate for the VHF, UHF, as well as the low frequencies. Your question, what do you see when you look at the end after you take a connector off? Many people take a connector off and they see very green copper in the center conductor. If they cut the jacket back a little bit, they may see some very green colored braid. This is a function of moisture or water getting into the cable. Both of those situations is an oxidization process, which makes your attenuation go up rapidly. Of course, when you get up into your VHF, UHF, that type of attenuation can wipe you out very rapidly. The reason for that is your radio frequency signals travel on the outer surface of the conductor. It's what they call skin effect.
The center conductor.
That's correct. So if that center conductor is corroded, that's where your signal is traveling. You can imagine then what's happening with as far as your signal being attenuated. I've seen it and I've heard it many times where guys are complaining about their coax. All of a sudden their SWR is way up, da-da-da-da-da, and they're losing signal. And one of the old myths, there will be people who argue with me on it, but I still consider it a myth, is what they call the non-contaminating jacket. Military, in their high-frequency applications, established that the plasticizer used in the vinyl jackets under heat would cause the plasticizer to migrate out of the jacket, go into your cable, and would then increase the attenuation, reduce your signal output.
When you say migrate, you mean leak?
Yeah, it'd be just like water, if you will, only it's going to the inside into your braid of your cable. And then, of course, depending upon how your cable is hanging, one of those connectors is going to have some of it go into it. Now, it takes a long time for something like that to occur. In fact, I think, if I recall correctly, the military testing on this was 7 days in an oven at 120 degrees Fahrenheit. They measured the attenuation of a 50-foot piece of cable and then put it in the air circulating oven at 120 degrees Fahrenheit for 7 days, and then would measure the attenuation after that 7-day period. And again, it was this plasticizer that they were trying to measure the causing the attenuation to go up.
You're listening to the Rain Report from www.rainreport.com.
When I say myth, it's not a myth that occurs. It is a myth for most amateur applications, especially in the low bands, that occurs. Typically, they pull the connector off and they get this stuff coming out of the cable. It's not the plasticizer. It's water and moisture that has gotten into the cable. and non-contaminating jacket or whatever you want to call will not preclude the moisture getting into the cable. If you got a pinhole anywhere along that jacket surface caused by rubbing it on something or just accidentally stuck it on something, you can bet moisture will start moving into that cable. And that's what causes your attenuation to go up, signal loss, high SWR. Now, obviously, take you like that 9913. That's why you had to be very, very careful in making certain that that end where you put the connector on was sealed very, very well because of the amount of airspace available in that cable. It was pretty easy to suck water all the way through that thing.
Is there any point to buying coax with non-contaminated jacket?
My personal opinion, Hap, is no. Now, at the same time that I say no, if you're a purist and you're up there in the UHF area, then I would understand somebody's reasoning to go after non-contaminating jacket because there's enough plasticizer that can come out with heat that could cause you attenuation problems up in that frequency range. And I can't tell you the frequency right off the top of my head, but I want to say it was 1 gig is where we had a Klystron where we did aged attenuation testing for a particular cable for the military. At that frequency range, you could measure the difference with the non-migrating jacket versus the standard vinyl jacket.
Well, if you're operating 440 megahertz, 220, 2 meters, and especially below 50 megahertz, then what you're saying is it's really not an issue.
In my opinion, it is not. The purist will argue that it is. Again, what I argue with the purist is, do you have equipment that is sensitive enough to measure the attenuation change? My knowledge at this point in time, that's not available.
Why do we need to be concerned about impedance changing in coax?
If you look at the data, 75 ohms gives you the optimum signal characteristics, where 50 ohms gives you the optimum power carrying capabilities. For an example, if you introduce something into your production line that causes periodicity, a change in a dimension on a very regular basis. So let's say we got a change that is, let's say it's a quarter wavelength for 2 meters. You have 150 feet of cable strung out. So you have that change in that dimensional characteristic every quarter wave all the way along that 150 feet. And you plug your equipment in, and all of a sudden, you don't hear anything at 144.5 megahertz. It essentially is acting as a filter and sucks the signal out. That's another one of those manufacturing process controls that you have to be extremely careful of. If you have a pulsating drive motor on your extruder, or if you have a couple pulleys that the bearings are starting to wear out, you can develop a pulsation in that line. And when you apply a structural return loss test to it or shoot it and looking for reflections, you'll see like a big old suck out spike on the oscilloscope. Time domain reflectometers can show you exactly where it's at in the cable and what the frequency that it relates to and everything of that nature. So that's one of those elements that any good coax manufacturer will be testing the cables. And they'll be testing them 100% up to a point of statistical control to ensure that for the frequency range advertised for the cable, that it does not have a periodicity problem.
I've been speaking with Ron Steer, W9ICZ, of Richmond, Indiana. And Ron worked for Belt and Wire and Cable for 37 years, retiring in 2000, having helped them with engineering, marketing, and even quality assurance. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago.
The Rain Report is copyright 2003 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9 SEQ.